I don't even know how to describe you, Ali. You're like, I want to say you're like you're like the paternal uncle of Palestine news and like reporting and analysis. Like, I feel like I've grown up reading your pieces and also like with Electronic Intifada. So for me, like, I feel like I'm like what my podcast does to make this all about me for a second. I continuing this tradition of kind of news and talking about Palestine because, you know, it's the topic you can't talk about and whatever, and it's something that you have to fight to do. So I it's really remarkable. It's really exciting for me to have you on to talk about all this stuff. I feel like as we said in the chat before this, like, we're gonna agree on everything to do with Palestine. So I wanted to kind of find a way into our conversation, but maybe for anyone who doesn't know you, Ali, can you introduce yourself? And to tell people what you do, but everybody knows you. How could they not know Electronic Intifada and Ali Abu Nima?
Well, thank you. That's very kind. You do make me feel a little bit old, but that's okay. I think I am a little bit old, and maybe this is an opportunity to come to terms with that. Well, I am the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada, which is an independent, and by independent I mean not funded by the National Endowment for Democracy or the European Union. I mean actually independent news outlet that focuses on Palestine and everything related to Palestine. And we were established in 2001, myself and three other co-founders, and today we have a team of 8 people, but we work with many writers and photographers and contributors in Palestine and in other countries. And every day is an adventure, and we're very happy that we can perform a service that you and others still think is useful. I personally look forward to the day when we're no longer needed, but I don't think that's going to happen too soon, unfortunately.
I actually have like I have like kind of two minds of this conversation. Like, I want to be like I want to ask you questions like publisher questions and also like internet and journalism questions because I'm new to like this field more and definitely and you've been doing this journalism for decades now. And I'm sorry to make you feel old. I think you are a bit older than me. You're like Gen X. You're like a solid Gen X guy because I was reading Electronic Intifada in college. So I associate like I remember sitting in my college dorm reading this like website that people were like, "Have you read Electronic Intifada?" And that but that not only was it like 20 years ago, but it was also like 7 different internets ago that that was happening. And I feel like I have so many questions for you about like what you've seen change and like as like a publisher of information and journalism and stuff because I feel like there's so much history there that like you've been there because you know, like you've been in this business for how long now? So I have, and like independent side and all the various iterations, pivot to video. So anyways, I have a ton of like media guy questions.
Yeah, and those, you had a conversation about that with my colleague, Nora Barrows-Friedman and John Elmer a few months ago. On your show, which was fascinating to me. It made me think about those things in a way I don't usually think about them. And I'm happy to talk about them.
Yeah, but I think at the outset though, it would be useful to kind of like delve into something that's really been in the news, which is I mean like okay, so it's like a functional problem talking to you because like where do we start? Like the what are the latest like unspeakable crimes of the Zionist state? Like do you start with that or like which I like you know, I kind of hesitate to do, but I think the fact that this law, this, you know, a yet another iteration of genocide and ethnic cleansing, like structural ethnic cleansing supported by virtually every faction of the Knesset, these new citizenship laws whereby Palestinians are no longer able to marry whom they choose, which is, you know, I mean, can you tell us a little bit about it and like what's the state and all that?
Well, the first thing you need to know is that it is very, very anti-Semitic to call Israel an apartheid state. And it It's yeah, and we should not do that because if there's one thing Israel isn't, it's an apartheid state. And even using that word in the same star system as Israel is anti-Semitic. And so we definitely shouldn't do that when talking about Israel's so-called citizenship and nationality law, which was just renewed in this past few days in the Knesset. This law was first enacted in 2004, and basically it says if you're an Israeli citizen, you cannot marry a Palestinian from the West Bank or Gaza Strip, or the citizen, or marry someone from a number of so-called enemy states and live with them in Israel. So basically, it's a law that prevents Israeli citizens from marrying Palestinians from the West Bank or Gaza or from other or who are living in other countries. And it's a law that primarily targets Palestinian citizens of Israel. There are about 1.5 million Palestinians who do have Israeli citizenship. It is second-class citizenship, but citizenship nonetheless. And they're the ones who would primarily marry Palestinians from the West Bank or Gaza because there are, community ties and familial ties that span the Israeli-imposed colonial boundaries, very similar to how there are families that span the U.S.-Mexico border who are divided by that border. So the reason for this law is very plain and clear, and Israeli politicians are not shy about it. It's about preventing the increase in the non-Jewish population. In other words, it's to stop there being too many Palestinians, of course, being the indigenous people. So they're saying, if you want to marry a Palestinian, that's fine, but you have to leave the country. And this law was passed as an emergency law in 2004, or it may have been 2003, but around that time, which meant that it had to be renewed every single year. It was renewed every year, except for last year when the new government came in, and it didn't. It wasn't the reason it lapsed was not because suddenly, Israelis said, "Oh, this is a bad law." It was simply because of political shenanigans in Israel. It had nothing to do with the substance of the law. But they said, as soon as we can renew it, we will, and that's what they did this week. But this time they added to it a specific reference, like before, for the previous, 19, 18 or 19 years, they said that the excuse was that this is a security law. That they would say openly, like with a nudge and a wink, "Well, we say it's security, but it's really about demographics." Now they've actually put into the law that this is about demographic gerrymandering and maintaining a Jewish majority within the Israeli state. So, yeah, but definitely don't call that apartheid because that would be incredibly offensive.
Yeah, I mean, it's so like the kind of persistent, never-ending, like all-inclusive, totalizing kind of race war aspect of Zionism is so naked all the time and basically always has been, in virtually every contour from, but then there is this kind of like obsession with, and we say it's demography, right? We use the colloquial, like the colloquialism, the euphemism of demography, right? Oh, it's demographic. It's like, oh, this is about race war. That's what it is. It's like this never-ending race war that Zionism and settler, which is it's settler colonialism in general, which is a form of settler colonialism, obviously. But like this never-ending race war that's unfolding under over so many fronts, whereby the very mention of anything Palestinian is so enraging and so like your existence as a people is offensive. I always think, like, what's it like to be Palestinian, where you're told that your very existence is somehow unsanctioned, right? That this is a contravention to some kind of normalcy, that the very name, right? So like I always think of like how petty the Zionists are when they release one of their hostages. Obviously, they're not prisoners, they're hostages. We call them prisoners, but whatever. They release these like, you know, colonial subjects that they keep in their prisons for 15, 20 years, God knows how long, decades. And then you're not allowed to like bring a flag to like pick them up and stuff. Like the very representation of that land is offensive, right? And I can't help but think, especially as we're watching like all these like media outlets get shut down left and right, which, as we know, Palestinians are like old hands in the cancel culture wars. And, you know, we can talk about that too, obviously. But I feel like there's something interesting that like reminded me of this essay that Said wrote in like 1984 called Permission to Narrate. And I think it was republished in The Question of Palestine. And it's always been something that kind of stuck in my mind, one of the unique aspects of the Palestinian story, whereby, you know, around the world, we've accepted that, oh, you know, terms like self-determination of peoples, right? Like these are all things that liberalism supposedly stands for, right? Like the famous, what's the thing, the Woodrow Wilson, the points thing, whatever, like that's like the dream of liberalism to sort of like outline. And of course it goes to war. It uses that logic, right? So like Kosovars were denied their human rights, so we had to bomb, you know, the former Yugoslavia to bits to like punish them, right? So like this is more than just like a rhetoric, but it is a kind of like logic of power. Except when it comes to Palestinians, like Palestinians are always that kind of, there's always like this asterisk on them whereby every normal measure of anything would seek to include them, right? So like we live in a world where we talk about decolonization and indigenous people, indigenous sovereignty rights. Do those conversations like include Palestinians? Often no, right? Like they're excluded from those, like from basic things of like human rights, from, you know, from the right to not be subjected to racial kind of categorization and minoritization by the state, right? Like Israel is an anachronism of a state, right? Like in its very formation, it's an anachronism, at least in the sense of, you know, ethno-states are something that liberalism eschews, right? But then of course, liberalism is its own fucking bullshit machine getting high on its own supply since forever. And when has it ever been true that its supposed principles are something that it like measures, it's like that it actually lives up to them, right? So it's so interesting to find this thing of like Palestinians lacking this sort of what, like, you know, talking about this permission to narrate. And I wanted to read something to you. Between August 29th and September 7th, 1983, the United Nations held an international conference mandated by the General Assembly on the question of Palestine. The conference was to be held in Paris, but worried by the threat of demonstrations and incidents from French Zionist organizations, the Mitterrand government requested that it be held elsewhere. France's quid pro quo to the UN, which was actually entitled to hold the conference in Paris at UNESCO's extraterritorial headquarters, was to be full participation by France. The conference was duly moved to Geneva, and France just as duly reneged on its promise and participated, quote, only as an observer. 137 nations showed up, a fact repeatedly changed to 75 nations by the U.S. press. The central document of the conference was to be Profile of the Palestinian People. The title and the study's focus were specified by the General Assembly. With a small group of other experts, I was engaged to produce the profile. It went to the Secretary General's office for 3 months and was returned for discussion to the preparatory committee of 20-odd nations. There it sat to the beginning of June, at which point I was told that the profile could not and would never be approved or used at the conference. The reasons were given, as usual, diplomatic and diverse. But, as an apologetic ambassador from a friendly Arab country made clear to me, by positing the existence and historical narrative of Palestinian people, the profile has, quote, created, end quote, a dual nationality problem for the Arab countries in which Palestinians had been dispersed since 1948. The same strictures and fears apply to the proposal I made to conduct the first ever census of Palestinians, most of whom live in the Arab world. There is an Arab context and an Israeli context, I was told. To speak of Palestinians outside of the occupied territories was to challenge the collective Arab narrative. In the words of a young Arab Third Secretary, to view history in too, quote, liberal and Western a way. Thus, no Palestinian narrative, no profile, no census. Palestine, yes. Palestinians, no. And, like, I remember reading this, like, ages ago and just thinking, like, wow, man, I think this was later put into the Question of Palestine, which I think is an overlooked book. Big time overlooked, and I think it's like definitely not appreciated. Anyways, all of this is to say that like the Electronic Intifada and like your work like is finally a recognized that like you don't have to ask permission to narrate anymore. That with the internet you can kind of just narrate yourselves. Now, is it easy? No. But I feel that like, do you think that problem of narration has been solved? Or are we still in that, are Palestinians, I mean, they still are, obviously, in like the mainstream whatever world, but like, you know, is that different than the permission to narrate? Or have Palestinians stopped asking permission to narrate?
Well, that's a good question. And what this makes me think of is the recent attention or lack of attention, depending where you look, to the Amnesty International report concluding that Israel perpetrates the crime of apartheid against Palestinians, the crime of apartheid being defined in international law under the 1975 Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid, and again in the Rome Statute, which established the International Criminal Court in 2000. So the crime of apartheid is one of the most serious crimes against humanity in international law. And so with the publication of the Amnesty report just a few weeks ago, I mean, I think it was in February, this comes, you know, a year after Human Rights Watch and B'Tselem being, you know, a well-known Israeli human rights organization, and Human Rights Watch, of course, being, along with Amnesty, one of the best, you know, one of the brand name human rights organizations in the world. And so when Amnesty came out with the report, it did get, you know, relatively a lot of attention. The New York Times amazingly ignored it. Like, they didn't even try to put a spin on it. They just ignored it altogether, which I think was the most honest thing they could do. But, you know, it did get some attention. But the point that many Palestinians made, and even some non-Palestinians made, is that, you know, yes, it's great that Amnesty is recognizing Israeli apartheid. It's great that Human Rights Watch did. But Palestinians have been saying this literally for decades. And to the extent that this is believed at all or understood at all, it's now only because, you know, non-Palestinian organizations like Amnesty or even Israeli organizations like B'Tselem are saying it. And that problem is still there. So, I mean, I'll give you an example. I listen to the BBC World Service a lot, which is terrible. You know,
yeah. Why do you do that to yourself? Are you like a masochist?
It's something I've done all my life, and it's available to me in the car. And so whenever I'm in the car, I have it on, because it's even harder to listen to NPR. But that's another story. Well, you might ask me why I don't just listen to music. Well, because I like to listen to news. That's what I do. But anyway, so you can have Russians reporting about Russia, maybe not now, but like I'm talking in the last few years. You can have South Africans reporting about South Africa. You can have, you know, a French reporter reporting about France, and so on. But you can never have, it's an absolute taboo. I've never heard on any mainstream media, maybe with very rare brief exceptions. But as a general rule, you cannot have a Palestinian reporting about Palestine on any mainstream Western outlet. You can have, of course, as has been the standard practice of the New York Times, for example, almost every New York Times bureau chief in Jerusalem is an American Jew. So that's not considered, you know, somehow compromising to objectivity. And there have even been cases like Ethan Bronner, a few years ago, whose son was in the Israeli army while his father was Jerusalem bureau chief. And that wasn't considered a conflict of interest. But you cannot have a Palestinian. And why is that? You know, I suppose the idea would be that Palestinians are not trustworthy to talk about what is happening to them. And that has really not, I think, substantively changed.
I guess the bigger question I'm asking is that in the time that Said wrote that in 1984, there was a kind of monopoly on information, in a sense that there were hard boundaries to not only like writing, but maybe not writing, but in terms of like the media infrastructure required to inform people in creative, dynamic, engaging ways, right? With like high print quality, high production quality. Like those options were limited. That was a different era. And I feel that like you and I are of the digital era, where like the ability to sort of set up a website and or set up a podcast or a YouTube channel. Now, can they go after you? Do you lose those rights? Yes, obviously. But I guess the question I'm asking you is, does it matter as much that the mainstream news media, which loses relevance every day? I guess this is the question. Like, how important is it less important now than the power, like the stranglehold of mainstream news over people conversing and sharing media with each other, right? Like, I guess I'm asking, like, would it make a difference if all of a sudden overnight ABC, NBC, CBS, they all go pro-Palestinian, like overnight? Would it make a difference in the power relationship between the settler colonists of Zionism and against the indigenous people? Like, I don't think so. Like, what does media power mean in the end?
Well, that's a really good question. Let's think about that for a minute, because I think I have some contradictory answers and feelings about this. But for example, if you take the present moment, is it significant that, you know, since 2016, you know, American cable television and newspapers have been propagandizing Americans that Russia is their enemy and Russia stopped Hillary Clinton from becoming president and, you know, Russia did this and Russia did that. Is that significant? Has it shaped American opinion in ways that have political significance? I think it has, and I think it shows the power of that even if, you know, legacy media or mainstream media is less important or less influential or less of a monopoly, it still has tremendous power. You know, Rachel Maddow was able to rot the brains of many millions of Americans over the last few years.
Someone put this together from just one episode of her show from last March, and I'm gonna play it for you. Here we go.
Vladimir Putin, Russia, 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 hate, Russia, 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 Putin, Russia's, Russia, 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 Russian, 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 Russia, Russia, Moscow, Moscow, Russia, Russian, pro-Russian, Russian, Russia, Russian, 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 the Russians, Russian, Russia, Russia, Russians, Russians, Russia, Russians, Russian, 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 Russia, Russian, 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 Moscow, Russian, Russian, Russia, Putin, Russian, 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 Russian against us. Russians, the Russians rush against the U.S. The Russians rush, 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 Russian, Russian, the Russian government scheme. The Russians, Vladimir Putin, Russia, Vladimir Putin, Russia, Putin, Putin and Russia, Russia, Moscow, Russia, Russian, Russian, Russia, the Russians, Russian, Russians, Russia, Russia, Russian, Russian, Russia, Russia, Putin, 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 Russian, 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 Russia, the Soviet Empire, the second of the 20th century's great evils, communism, Russia,
communism,
Russia, assault by Russia, 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 Russia's, Russia's,
Russia, Putin despises the West in general and the United States in particular, the Soviet Empire. Russia,
Russia, Russia.
They're the adversary. They want to bring us down, the Soviet Union.
So, and if it were not significant, I mean, you know, like Chris Hayes on MSNBC, which I never watched, but I hear that he has a show, you know, doesn't talk about Palestine, doesn't talk about Yemen, doesn't talk about any of these things. And I think they don't talk about them is because they know that they are watched and they are influential and they're not allowed to have that kind of influence on the public when it comes to issues like Palestine or Yemen or whatever else it might be. So yes, it still matters. But in another sense, I would say it matters much less to me in this sense that I don't care anymore. Like, I don't try to, you know, there was a period for many years where I did try to get published in, you know, the LA Times or the Chicago Tribune or the New York Times or, you know, wherever it was. And I did, you know, get published in them. It was always a battle, you know, it was like 9 times out of 10, if not worse odds, your piece would not get published. And if it did get published, they would hack it and butcher it and change it and soften it. And it was always such like a stressful and frustrating and time-wasting experience. And, you know, then you'd get something published in the New York Times and everyone would be so happy. Oh, my God, look, he's in the New York Times and he's able to say these things. You'd get a little rush from that. But then, you know, what did it really change? It didn't really change anything. And it cost a lot in terms of just time I could be doing other things. So now I don't even try it. I don't submit op-eds to any other publications. I mean, if I were invited, I'd consider it. If they called me up and said, would you be interested in sending it? You know, sure, I might do it. It's not like it's a matter of principle, but it's a matter of, is it worth my time to pursue this? No. Do I care about getting 2 minutes on CNN or MSNBC? No, I don't care. You know, I'm not interested. And I'm certainly not interested at the price of not saying the things I want to say. You know, I've pointed out in the past few weeks, given like just the what I see as like a shock doctrine moment for censorship, where they're using the whole war in Ukraine to greatly ramp up censorship on social media and, you know, in the so-called West in general. But it's like in May, for example, when Israel was bombarding Gaza and targeting high-rise buildings and apartment buildings and killing whole families, what were the networks that had me on? You know, I'm doing this from memory, but for sure Al Jazeera, for sure TRT, the Turkish state broadcaster or public broadcaster, probably CGTN. I think I was invited by CGTN, which is China. I can't remember if I did it or not, but they definitely invited me. And probably also RT. So anyway, those are the ones that typically will have me on. And some independent media, of course. And of course, infamously, the exception was Deutsche Welle. Deutsche Welle, the German government broadcaster, made the mistake of inviting me on for a live interview. I mean, just the point I was making is that in the past, I did get, you know, not often, but I did get invited onto the BBC World Service. I did get invited onto CNN. I did get invited onto MSNBC. I even got invited onto Fox. I'm talking about in the early 2000s. Now that's just unthinkable. You know, it's completely unthinkable. So, yeah. That's fine with me. But like the point I was making, I said this in a, you know, I was reflecting on this the other day on Twitter, is that like Chinese TV, Turkish TV, Russian TV, Al Jazeera, nobody ever told me what I can say or can't say, you know? Nobody ever told me, yeah, you can't go here, you can't criticize there. I've criticized Qatar on Al Jazeera, I've criticized Turkey on TRT, they have me back on. So you could say the only freedom of speech I have is in the media of the so-called authoritarian states. You know, this, I'm talking as a Palestinian, as someone talking about Palestine. That's the reality. Those are the only places where I've been given freedom of speech on Palestine. I have zero access to, you know, any mainstream American media. Zero. None. I mean, I'm not complaining about it. I'm just observing because, like I say, I'm not willing to, you know, to court them or try to go on if the price is not saying the things I want to say. But then back during May, the exception was Deutsche Welle, the German broadcaster, who invited me on, like a producer contacted me. And I was like, yeah, sure, I can come on and talk about that. And I was like, is this recorded? Is this live? They said, no, it will be live. And I immediately knew. I said, these people are making a huge mistake to offer me a live interview. And I am going to make sure, that they regret it to the utmost. It is funny in a way, but it got really serious because what happened was, this was in May, I did the interview with Deutsche Welle. You can watch the video at the Electronic Intifada. If people just search for, you know, Ali Abunehmed Deutsche Welle, you know, they'll find it. you know, basically, I just told them some home truths. I told them that, you know, Germany supports Israel out of Holocaust guilt, and Palestinians are sick of paying the price for guilty German consciences and Palestinian children being killed to make Germans feel better, basically. And I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but that was the sentiment. And they did freak out. So then the German Deutsche Welle, I actually learned about this from a German Turkish journalist who contacted me to ask me my reaction. And I found that the Deutsche Welle had put out a statement through the official German press agency, DPA, condemning my interview, which is just so strange, such a strange thing to do. And the German press agency, you know, I guess being a government mouthpiece, didn't like contact me to get a comment from me. They just ran, you know, Deutsche Welle's statement. And Deutsche Welle issued internal guidelines, which were leaked and published on the internet, saying, we don't allow people to talk about Israeli apartheid. We don't allow the word colonialism. You know, all these restrictions on what you're allowed to say on Deutsche Welle about Israel. So very strict censorship. This memo went out following my interview and saying how hosts, you know, that the mistakes were made in terms of selecting this guest, and hosts will be trained to interrupt guests and cut them off and, you know, not allow them to say these true and yet offensive things. But that was that. But what then happened over the subsequent months is that there was a witch hunt within Deutsche Welle. And this was orchestrated, you know, with the complicity of the rest of the German media and the German state, basically, a witch hunt against Arab journalists working in Deutsche Welle. And a number have been fired. I wrote about this a month or two ago. This witch hunt that led to the firing of all these journalists because of comments they had made critical of Israel. And often these comments were things taken out of, completely taken out of context in order to, to smear them as anti-Semites. And, you know, the usual tactics on the basis that, and these were sometimes, like, they, for example, they fired the head of Deutsche Welle Arabic Bureau in Beirut because of a tweet he'd made years ago saying that, you know, collaborators with Israel should face the death penalty. Now, I happen to oppose the death penalty in all cases, but you're going to tell me that it's somehow like anti-Semitic for somebody who is in a state that is at war with Israel to say that people who collaborate with that state that has invaded Lebanon countless times, killed tens of thousands of people, and attacks it regularly, that's somehow anti-Semitic? Like, now, if you were to say that Ukrainians who collaborate with the Russian forces or who are spies for Russian forces shouldn't be tried and shouldn't even... If you were to say the same thing, people would say, yeah, of course, it's a war. And that's what states do to traitors in wartime. So that's why they fired the head of the Beirut office of Deutsche Welle Arabic, and other people were fired for like completely innocuous things. But I don't know if it was because of my interview, but certainly I think that my interview contributed to this chain of events in which they were like, yeah, we really need to tighten the screws and the censorship to prevent people from talking about Israel in a negative way, basically. And that, you know, that's sort of an extreme example because it's Germany, you know, and Germany always has to do things to the extreme. But but the same process is visible in all the Western media. So famously, you know, in Canada, there was a decision a year or two ago, it came out that you're not allowed to say the word Palestine on the CBC, on the on the Justin Trudeau regime broadcaster, you can't say the word Palestine. And whether those things are spoken or unspoken rules, they are rules throughout most of the so-called free Western media. And this is the media that the genius of it is they have convinced their populations that they are the free media. They are the ones where you can say whatever you want.
Yeah, that's
and that's
the crazy thing.
That it's incredible. But that's why the, you know, it's become a cliche, or, well, it's true. Maybe it's a cliche because it's true, that the American public, but I would extend that to the so-called Western public generally, is the most successfully propagandized public in the world. In fact, Joseph Mesad had this great article in Middle East Eye a few days ago about the new wave of Russophobia. And he talks about how Western publics are just so propagandized, and how when he came to the US in the early 80s to go to college, he couldn't believe how Americans just believed everything their government said and their media said. And he said, you know, growing up in Jordan, where there's an authoritarian regime, everyone knew not to trust the media or the government. You know, so his argument was that growing up in a, you know, what would be called an authoritarian regime in Western media actually produces democratic skepticism. Whereas growing up in a so-called Western democratic regime, in most people, produces like complete credulity and trust in these governments that, you know, are just committing atrocities around the world.
Yeah, no, I mean, I remember now the firings, and yeah, it's totally how basic they have to, like, how kind of brute force they have to use to silence anyone, and the excuses they have. Now, I'm of the view, I don't know, maybe this is just me, and like, I, you know, I'm in a position that I can just say this kind of stuff, but like, I see those things as like a pride thing. Like, good, I'm glad I got fired for like something as stupid as that, because like, it proved to me that like the system that I'm a part of, that you're a part of, like, you proved yourself how you're like, in destroying themselves, in destroying, stamping out any mention of Palestine, the breadth of it, that they've already proven that they're not, that, and they've shown anyone who's paying attention that they don't actually believe in their principles. So I always find it, and maybe that's just like me, my own like liberal reading of it, that like, it's good that they, because they do this to us too, right? Like, the, all the things that they're doing to Russia now, they did this to Iranian state TV. Like, you can't, they chase down every IP address. They go after like videos. It's just like petty shit. And I'm used to it. And I'm, you know, it's just, you know, it's just like, this is, you know, it's common. This is an American tactic, right? Like, this is the imperialist tactic, is that if you won't allow them to spread their, you can't allow them permission to narrate. God forbid some people like watch those, you know, English broadcasts, like interview with some rando, because ultimately they're not interested in living up to their supposed principles, but they're insecure and they can't stand the thought of someone challenging their worldview. And I feel, at least in part of it, like that's the, like, that's the gift of being Palestinian. I don't know. I'm not Palestinian, so I don't have the right to say that. But like, if from my perspective, like, it gives you like ethical seeing eyeglass, like it gives you like X-ray goggles in a sense in the world of like, oh, who's a bullshitter about their values and who isn't? Like, who's able to stick to their principles and who doesn't? And like, that's where the phrase Palestine is still the issue comes from, right? Like, that's the meaning of it. Palestine is still the issue means that like, it's a litmus test. I mean, I've always wanted to sort of have this conversation. Is it the litmus test now? Because there's a lot of supposedly pro-Palestine people who are very reactionary, but we won't talk about that. But I guess maybe we'll talk about that today, because there's other conversations. I still want to ask you like publisher question.
Sure.
Because we are 45 minutes into the conversation.
Really? The time and flies I feel like I'm having fun.
Yeah, me too. This is a lot of fun. I don't know how I'll divide this up, but I guess this is related to the permission to narrate thing, because as much as like the horror, these horror show at Deutsche Welle and whatever, like, you know, people's lives are obviously impacted and careers and stuff, but like, there is a freedom now, a freedom to like make media, make content and share it that hasn't existed before. Right. And it is easier and easier to do that stuff. And this is kind of to repeat that question, But I kind of want to see, I'm curious to see if you can kind of tell me a story, like tell the story of Electron Intifada, but can you like refract it through the changing internet? So like, how did Electronic Intifada like evolve?
Yeah.
And like, you got to watch it evolve. I guess you evolved with it, because that, like, I remember the blog Electronic Intifada. I mean, it's still basically like a news site with hyperlinks and stuff. Like the simplicity of it is also kind of beautiful. All the years, it's basically the same thing. Obviously, layout and stuff has changed. I'm trying to remember what it used to look like. It's not coming to me, honestly. I can't tell you.
Yeah.
Maybe you have like pictures of it somewhere.
Well, I think it's on the web archive. I mean, people can go back and find what it looked like. And it's like one of those things. It's like seeing a photo of yourself when you're an awkward 13-year-old. You know, it's kind of in a way. I mean, here's what I want to say. Maybe start at the end of the story and then go to the beginning. But yes, we have this freedom, and it's essential. You know, we have this ability to create media and share it, but we're still dependent on platforms we don't control. And there really is no solution that I see to that problem now. You know, I'm this isn't necessarily my field. I'm not like someone who understands all the technology and you know how that develops, but we have a monopoly problem that basically we are beholden to a few large Silicon Valley companies, Google, Facebook, Twitter, and, you know, a couple of others. YouTube is owned by Google, of course. They did allow this freedom for a few years, and now clearly they're not. And so they manipulate the algorithms so that our stuff becomes less visible. And there was a moment when Facebook did that in 2016. For a few years prior to 2016, I remember this, like, you know, 2011, 12, 13, 2014 during the Gaza war, we would put certain stories on Facebook and they would just go completely viral. I mean, we could reach millions of people easily. And then in June 2016, Facebook announced a change. This was a publicly announced change that they were basically changing the algorithm so that news would be less visible in people's feeds and it would promote more like personal stuff, baby pictures, cat pictures. I don't know what it was, why they were doing that, but this was in June 2016. And we saw an immediate drop in traffic from Facebook, a really sharp drop, but it was something like 40%. And many other left-wing and independent news sites said the same thing at that time. I think the World Socialist website wrote a really good piece documenting this at the time and showing how this drop in traffic all happened at this time that Facebook changed that algorithm. And since then, like, you know, we just, all of these things are so opaque, we don't know. So the question is, if they take away our access to Twitter, if they take, which could happen nowadays, I could be suspended or, my account could be taken away by Twitter on the most flimsy excuse, as has happened to many people, particularly Palestinians. Facebook loves shutting down the accounts of Palestinian journalists and publications and has done so many times, mostly publications in Palestine. So if they take away our access to Facebook, if they take away our access to Twitter, if Google, downranks our results, then do we really have this ability to reach people? You know, that's a real problem and a real vulnerability that I don't know the solution to, but it's becoming more and more urgent. And what's frightening is to see as, and that's why, you know, I oppose censorship as a matter of principle. I oppose shutting, you know, stopping people from seeing RT or Sputnik or Press TV or whatever it is as a matter of principle, because I know that all, and of course, before RT was censored, before Sputnik was censored, they were shutting down Palestinian outlets in Palestine that most people hadn't, you know, people outside Palestine don't even know who they are. But these were pages that Palestinians relied on for news, but because Israel accused them of so-called incitement, Facebook shut them down. So what I'm saying is that what's frightening for me is to see so many so-called progressives and leftists cheering when Twitter shuts down or says we're going to make content from these sites less visible. They're like, yes, why didn't you do that earlier? Or why didn't you, why don't you go further? And it's just horrifying to me because it's just being so normalized that people cheer for their enemies to be silenced. And like, you know, as I've said also, I'm not in love with Israel. I think people know that. But I don't, I've never called for Israeli media to be censored, you know, or blocked on Twitter or Facebook or anything. And in fact, I read it every day. It's essential for me to read it. I need to read it to understand the full context of what's happening in Palestine. And why would that be less true in terms of Russian media? Why would I not want to be able to read and see and hear what people in Russia, including the Russian government, are saying and thinking? And the fact that people don't get that is just really discouraging to me. But that said, I feel like I should answer your question, because none of that, did any of that answer your question?
I forgot what my question
was. Well, you were asking about the
evolution. I forgot what the question was myself.
I mean, look, basically.
Well, yeah.
I mean, to put it in sort of a brief sense, I think EI started off as a reaction because the internet was becoming, and it, by the way, EI was also an evolution of what came before, which was in the early and mid-90s, we had listservs. Do they still have listservs? These are basically email discussion groups. And
no, listservs got swallowed up by social media. I mean, I guess they still exist among some freaks, but there's no point to them when you have social
right.
media.
Right, okay, so
because they're text based ultimately.
Yes.
They're like, it's that the dimensions of the internet as you've experienced it have changed, the media dimension.
Correct.
Like it went from being text based to something completely like text, video, audio, whatever, right? Like,
right, but what
it's quite the transformation. Yes. It's quite the evolution in 20 years too. It was like basically 20 years.
Yeah, but here's the thing about listservs is they were great. You know, I mean, they were a revelation. So you join a listserv and basically it would be like an email group, and later they had Google groups. I don't know if people still have that. But basically, I think people can understand a listserv because probably a lot of people have them at work with a small group of people. Like it's an email chain with a bunch of people. But there were listservs. The listservs were the first place I was able to network with other Palestinians and people interested in the question of Palestine or, you know, activists internationally. And even, you know, more than internationally, just like before that, it was like you had to go to a meeting to meet people, you know. So just that ability to share information, to get information very quickly, to connect with people who are there on the ground, it was revolutionary. Like, yeah, now maybe looking back, people say, oh, well, what's so exciting about an email group? It was incredibly transformative. And it provided the basis for a lot of activism because people could organize on listservs. Like they could organize action alerts that told people, you know, this newspaper published this really biased article, we should write to the editor. And so, you know, you could organize a little campaign and get a bunch of letters to the editor. You could put pressure on companies that were doing things. So it was an incredibly powerful tool for networking, for organizing, for getting to know people, for getting information directly. I can't stress that enough because before that, I couldn't get statements or accounts from small Palestinian organizations that were in the West Bank or in Gaza, whatever it was. That stuff was hard to get, you know? Or if you got it, it would come, you know, in a printed newsletter months or weeks after an event. So to get that stuff instantly. So then obviously that means, well, you say, well, you want to start sharing this. So you start your own listserv And then you start writing about the information, like, I received this and here's some context, and you share it with your listserv. So what I'm trying to describe is that nobody sat down and said, we're going to make a website and call it the Electronic Intifada and we're going to do these things. Everything was sort of a step-by-step evolution from something else. And then when the web started to become current, you know, sort of something non-nerdy, non-specialized people knew about, it was a very cheap way to start a website, you know, to reach people. But people start to know about it. You know, you still have to send out links on the listservs or let people know, because people didn't necessarily know how to find you. But it also evolved in terms of our, you know, it went from being a reactive thing, like, you know, the Chicago Tribune or the LA Times or CNN did this really biased report. We're going to write and demand a correction, or we're going to write and demand that they do this or that, to like, well, we can just write our own story the way it needs to be written and share it with a bunch of people. And now we can put it on a website. And so if you look at the earliest versions of the Electronic Intifada, you'd see that a lot of it is kind of media criticism and media reaction to media. And over time, it becomes much more about, well, we'll just do this ourselves. Why do we care what they're saying? We'll just do it ourselves. Then gradually, as the technology developed, then, you know, you can do things like podcasts and video. And I'm not, you know, I'm not the one who does, I think EI does some fantastic video, but I'm not the one who does them. You know, I'll work on scripts and I'll work on editing and that kind of thing. But I don't have those technical skills. So it's like the importance of having people, and we have a fantastic team, who know and understand all these new technologies. But to me, the fundamental thing, whether, you know, at any point, it's that the journalism has to be solid. And I'm old-fashioned about that. You know, it's like we all are, you know, in the sense that it's got to be factual, it's got to be accurate, it's got, you know, all those things. It's got to be trustworthy, because ultimately, I mean, there are always going to be people who are going to say, how can you trust an outlet called the Electronic Intifada? Or how can you trust, you know, Palestinians? Of course, they're going to be biased against Israel. But I think if you're consistent about the quality and the accuracy, most people will see the see what you do and see and understand what you do. And that you can never compromise on, because if you blow that trust, I mean, that's the only asset we have. We don't own buildings, we don't own real estate, we don't own a huge you know, newsroom like the New York Times. You know, really all we have is our laptops and our credibility. The laptops are replaceable. Your credibility is very hard to replace.
Well, it's interesting, because we're also at a radically different stage in history in terms of the role of the journalist, him or herself, right? Because there used to be this impression that journalism is... that the journalist figure is, what is it, the corny thing that people say, the first draft of history? Like, that idea of, like, here are these eyes on the ground who are employed by some kind of cultural institution, a print media institution, right, publication. Then they send out these individuals and they get paid to sort of, like, that model of a journalist is gone. People don't do that. Like, there's a few who are basically TV stars who go wherever is needed, but, like that's... You know, CNN doesn't even do, it's just a podcast now. Like, it's just it's the world's most, I've said this a lot on the show, it's like the world's most expensive podcast. Like, it's just a bunch of people sitting around. Like, journalism itself, I guess, as a field, as a profession, has declined because there are fewer jobs. I mean, this is the deeper dive into this is the episode you mentioned. It's called Is Journalism Dead? It's from like four or five months ago. And so, like, there is that, the fact itself, and this is the same thing that happened to my profession in academia, and like a kind of critical humanities is dying, you know, that kind of genres of, like, especially what I do, which is comparative literature. So, like, that I can appreciate those as kind of like media evolutions, as like kind of moments in media that, like, yeah, maybe the figure of the journalist has changed. Maybe it's not this globe-trotting, camera clad, you know, guy in a flak vest, right? Like, maybe we need to get rid of that idea of what a journalist is. Because ultimately, like, those people were translators, right? Like, they were cultural and sort of linguistic or whatever. They were kind of news translators and they were framers. Whereas now, you don't need somebody to quote, like, you know, what's the group? Soraya Al-Quds, the faction, or like, yeah, the Izzedine Al-Qassam.
Yeah.
But, like, you don't need, like, they have Telegram pages. They publish it themselves. You're like, oh, so-and-so said, right? Like, I guess I'm asking, like, what is the meaning of journalist today, journalism, when you have so much evidence, right? Isn't the sort of the liberating thing of modern journalism is that you have this information on the ground that's given to you. Now, can you astroturf that shit? Yes. I mean, case in point, Syria, 2011, like, yes, you can fake that stuff easily. But I guess what I'm saying is that, like, you don't need to be a globetrotting dude to go and, like, see different parts of the world, at least, or talk about them or narrate them, right? I guess what I'm saying is, like, I wonder if the need for that intermediary figure of the journalist is as necessary. I guess it is necessary, obviously. Like, you wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't do what I do if it wasn't necessary. Like, I don't consider myself a journalist, but I certainly have interviewed a bunch, and I certainly, like, appreciate the work that journalists do. But I'm seeing it more and more as, like, the same work that I did when I, like, talked about literature, that it's, like, critical.
Yeah.
Like, ultimately, that it's, like, it's a critic's job. It's not like a fiction writer. You're doing theory. And so, like, you're doing media interpretation. You're doing, like, representation. You're taking sources and you're finding, and it's not hard to get people to interview from the West Bank today,
yeah,
as it was 30 years ago. Like, it didn't require expensive phone calls or whatever. Now you can, like, get people to speak into their phone and give you quotes any day of the week. So, like the El Kurd family, like, you want to, like, I mean, if as terrible as what they're going through, like, I can say, like, one, like, thing is that, like, this family is, like, they all have, like, media degrees.
Yeah.
Like, they all have excellent abilities with the media. They know how to, like, forget even just communication, but in terms of, like, how the media works, like people's literacy of the media is so much higher now, too, than it was when, say, like, you were starting out and I was, like, reading the Electronic Intifada. You know? It's a crazy time. And, like, I don't think we stop and appreciate. God, listen to me. I'm like old man here. But, like, I'm going to turn 40 soon. And, like, so much has changed just since I was 20.
Yeah.
And in university. Like, just since I was 20. When I was 20, I didn't even have a laptop when I was in most of my university. I didn't have a smartphone until grad school. So, like, I feel like you and I are, like, the last generation of people to ever, like to ever know that pre-digital information world,
yeah,
pre-smartphones, pre-laptops,
yeah,
like, all that stuff. And it's curious to hear your, like, very romantic nostalgia for newsgroups, because it very much dates you, first of all, as, like, a Gen Xer, but also, like, that was the wild west of the internet.
Well, it wasn't.
Like, it wasn't.
I mean, it's not.
It wasn't police the way it was today.
Right. It's not romantic nostalgia. And this, I have no desire to go back to news groups or listservs. They were a pain in the ass too. When your inbox would get yeah, filled up with messages, yeah, that you couldn't keep up with. You know, it. But you know, it was. It opened doors and windows and created connections and networks that lasted years and that led to other things, enabled the kinds of, you know, information sharing and gathering. I mean, it sounds like a bullshit cliche, but a democratization of media that didn't exist before, that was very much a one-way relationship between the big broadcaster and the big newspaper and you as the passive consumer or reader or listener. And that relationship started to change then, where we could not only talk back much easier, but then start to talk to each other and to start to talk directly to a broadcast audience of our own. So it was transformative. But one thing I want to say, disclaimer, I still do not think of myself as a journalist. I recognize that people call me a journalist and think of me as a journalist, and so I just have to accept that. But I still, you know, I feel like I have nothing to do with and no interest in the so-called profession of journalism, and you know, all these professional journalists on Twitter who are constantly congratulating each other and boosting each other. And journalism school is something that, you know, I consider probably very bad for people who want to be journalists, because I think it's about networking and conformity, and these are institutions that are tied to power and privilege and the elite, and that to me is fundamentally counter to what journalism is supposed to be. To me, journalism, I guess I believe the liberal bullshit that journalism is the fifth estate or the fourth estate. I don't know how many estates there's supposed to be. But, you know, that the role of a journalist is to challenge those in power. Whatever the context is, that's the role of the journalist. It's to hold accountable those in power. So if you're a journalist and most of what you do is regurgitate the narratives of those in power, the narratives of the state or the narratives of NATO or the EU or the US government or whoever it is, that's not journalism. You know, I don't know what that is, but it's not, it's propaganda. You know, so to me, journalism is about questioning those in power, holding them accountable, exposing them, and giving a voice, or not giving a voice, that's the wrong term, but providing a space for the people whose voices are not heard. So I think we try to reflect that in the work we do as the Electronic Intifada. So the basic elements are there. We're constantly railing against the people in power and trying to expose them through rigorous factual journalism. Here's why the US government is bullshitting you. Here's why the EU is bullshitting you. Here's why, you know, the universities who claim to be the bastions of free speech and free inquiry are bullshitting you when it comes to Palestine. And at the same time, I have been to Gaza. You know, I was able to go in 2013. And that one visit, that one week I spent in Gaza, gave me a sort of a visual, I don't know what it is, a visual understanding or reference of the space and the geography, and the experiences I had with people were so incredible. And I would love to go to Gaza again, but I don't need to go to Gaza every month or every year. The role we can play is to support. There are fantastic journalists in Gaza who can do the reporting, who live there, who know it way better than I'm ever going to know it. And so our role is to support them, to publish them, to promote their work, and to let them tell the stories that I think would otherwise not be told, that are important for people to understand. And it's definitely helpful if I'm editing a story about Gaza and they're talking about, you know, a certain place and I've been there and I can visualize it. That's incredibly helpful to me to understand what I'm editing. But I don't need to be the one standing there in Gaza, if you see what I'm saying. I don't need to be the one with the flak jacket and the one who's in the spotlight. And as you say, there is so much information. What is our role? I think our role is to try to give people, you know, that we live in an era of infinite choice, but really not. But, you know, there is. You could spend time scrolling on your phone or on the internet all day and never run out of things to read. So people don't have to read EI. But what we want to provide is context and analysis and perspective that we think they're not going to get anywhere else, and that is true and sincere to what we believe and what we see and what we understand about the world. And people can love it, people can hate it. There's plenty of people who hate it, you know? And the thing that baffles me is people who get mad at me, like, for example, on Twitter, for like not saying the same thing as everyone else. Like, what would be the point if I just said the same thing as everyone else? Why would you need me then? You know? Why we could just have like a social media network with one account that, you know, just says everything we're supposed to think. Why get mad at me for not saying the same thing as like a zillion other people? You know, it just makes no sense to me. You don't have to read what I say. And if you read it, you don't have to like it or agree with it. But just like get off my back. I'm going to say it.
Yeah, this is the constant kind of like the what's the word? Like the Gordian knot of social media is that on the one hand, it is liberating and it is powerful. And that's like, you know, it's the basis of my show. Like the contacts that I make through my Twitter account, mostly like 90%. That's how I know you. That's how I know the entire team at Electronic Intifada. So like, it's important to me to maintain that account. Like I'm not going to go ahead, get myself suspended for like no reason. So I have to be smart on Twitter and on social media. So there is that kind of strategic thing. And what that means in my case is like, you know, so for instance, on Instagram, I better not post anything with like Soleimani's face or my 5,000 follower account on Instagram goes bye-bye.
Yeah, so you have to sell
like just
sensor.
A simple, which I'm used to, which like is like, it's, I know that like I'm Palestinians know that, like you just have to, like you just, so I, the freedom, the supposed freedom for me never existed. Like that was a negative experience. Rather, I see it more as these are the bounds that I'm allowed to explore on this and this platform. Now there are other platforms and I can use these different platforms to connect my different network and promote, and I can use them to their different advantage. And I think this is to what you said in the last point of like the sensitivity, like the fundamental weakness or whatever vulnerability, I think was your word, of projects like EI and also my show too, right? Ultimately, like my publisher is in the US, like I don't, you know, like I can't mess around. Now shutting down podcasts, I think is a different story, but that's coming. But like there's so many of them that you can hide kind of like a gorilla in like them in the wild. You can hide for a while and it would take the like a lot to like get you shut down. And I think that's basically true for Electronic Intifada too. Has anybody tried to like shut you down? Like from the ISP?
No. And I agree that probably would be difficult, although who knows
we may have just spoken too soon on that one. I should edit that out. It's bad karma to say that out
but
loud.
But I think it's not, you know, it's not that that's the main risk. The main risk is that, yeah, they'll allow you to exist, but no one will be able to find you, you know, and that's, you know, the search engines will be rigged. People got really mad, rightly so, DuckDuckGo, the supposed alternative to Google, because like a couple of days ago, the CEO proudly announced that they were going to start downranking so-called Russian disinformation sources. And of course, there's no definition of Russian disinformation. We don't know what that is. It could be anything that they don't like. And people got really mad, and rightly so, because it's like, you're an effing search engine. You know, it's like, we don't want you. You're not the New York Times. You just, we search, show us what's there. You know, rank it based on some kind of transparent algorithm, like, you know, the most link to or the most whatever it is, but they're manipulating results based on political criteria, and people are cheering for it. You know, if you look at the comments, you know, there were thousands and thousands of responses and quote tweets and whatever to the CEO of DuckDuckGo. A lot of them, I have to say, it was great to see how much negative reaction there was, and people saying, you know, you're dead to me now. Like you advertised yourself as an unbiased search engine that protected privacy, and you just proved you are no different than Google. But there are a lot of people who are saying, you know, it's so-called liberals, people self-identifying as liberals or whatever, you know, whatever it is, saying, you know, you should have done this earlier. And that's the frightening thing, is that people on the so-called left are cheering for censorship. And yes, they cheer for censorship against their enemies, or the people they perceive as their enemies, but they seem completely oblivious to how that's, you know, the first victims of that censorship are always people on the left or people who are otherwise marginalized, like Palestinians or Iranians or, you know, any number of other people. So it's, I think it's a real crisis. You know, it's, we're in a, you know, if I can provide any perspective on my, you know, 20 plus years of doing this kind of work, it's that I feel we're really at a moment where, or there was a period of a few years where the so-called mainstream media and the government were losing their grip on information. And this was particularly true following the, you know, in the early to mid 2000s and after the Iraq War, where the, you know, US government, the intelligence services, all of this were losing control of the narrative. And I think they have regrouped now and reasserted control in a way that is very frightening, very difficult to resist and oppose, and especially difficult to resist and oppose when so many people who claim to be liberals or Democrats or even progressives and leftists are happy to see this kind of censorship going on. So I'm very concerned about what is coming next. And I would be lying if I said I knew the solution. Like, whenever I tweet about censorship, you know, someone will inevitably respond and say, oh, go on such and such network. It's, you know, completely decentralized or whatever. But, you know, the point is, if nobody is there, you know, you can't, it's not an alternative. How we break these monopolies and establish truly free and independent platforms is a very difficult problem I don't know the answer to.
I have one answer, which is distributive in your publication. So every channel, every app, like, I think personally EI should have a foothold. I don't know. Like, do you guys have a Telegram channel? I don't think so.
Look, you know, you're right, but all of this is a huge amount
Telegram.
It's a huge amount of work as well. You know, it's like, I mean, that's
yes,
not to,
it is a new task.
Yeah. That's not to say it's a bad idea, but already we're managing, you know, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. And that's already a huge chunk of time. You know, every article you publish, you need to promote it on all these platforms repeatedly. And then you're going to add on YouTube. We have a YouTube channel, and then you're going to add Telegram, and you're going to add, I don't know what else. That's definitely a solution, but it brings additional costs. So I've just started a Telegram channel as a backup. I don't post on it yet. I might at some point, but it's just like, you know, I'm completely new to Telegram. I'm following, you know, I've joined some Telegram channels, so I'm seeing how people use it and how it's similar and how it's different from other social media platforms. But yeah, that's one solution. They shut you down on one, you still have another. But all of this comes with, you know, a lot of extra time and effort when you're already a very small team and you're already stretched. So
it's 1 hour and 40 minutes. Ali Abu Nima, I will let you go. Tell us what's on the docket, what's coming up on the EI website, also the podcast, the YouTube channel. I always say to you guys should advertise on my show. You guys should send me clips. Of course, not for free, obviously. I'll never charge you. Of course, I don't charge anybody to advertise on my podcast. Why the hell would I do that? But, like, you guys should send me your stuff. I'd be happy to promote it. We should, because a lot of listeners who listen to my show will listen to your show if they don't know, you know. So tell us what's coming and what we have waiting for us.
Well, thank you. And you know, we're very keen for our content to be shared. And so if there's ever, like, you want to just play some of the podcasts on your show, because I've noticed you've done that some episodes, you you ran that Mearsheimer lecture. So if there's ever anything you want to run, you just, you know, go ahead and do that. We would love that. And we'll definitely start sharing things with you. We've got, you know, to be honest, I sometimes do not know. I wake up in the morning, I do not know what I'm going to write about. But as you said, I will see something, whether it's on Twitter and it's in the news, and it's something that no one else has written about, or no one else has written about it the way I think it should be written about. And that's what I'll write about. But we do have, you know, each of us is, we kind of have beats. So we're following stories over time. We're following the, for example, the question of the International Criminal Court investigation on Palestine, and now how, like, you know, that's taken so many years even to get to the point where they open investigation. Now, like, in 5 minutes, they want to open investigation about Ukraine. We publish a lot of really good reportage from reporters in Gaza. We just published a piece, I think today or yesterday, about just like how hard it is to get like clean drinking water in Gaza. So, you know, just kind of the day-to-day stuff that people have to deal with that is just completely absent from the mainstream media. And you know, we have a fantastic podcast hosted by Nora Barros-Friedman, who you've had on. And I think, have you also had Asa Winstanley? You did. You had a great episode with Asa a few weeks ago. And he co-hosts the podcast with Nora. So, you know, I hope some of your listeners who don't know us will come over and check out the Electronic Intifada. I'm really proud of the work we do. I, you know, not to blow our own horn, but we work hard to try to put out something good every day. And I think if we weren't doing something of at least some value, we wouldn't have been there for more than 20 years by virtue of the support that we get from our readers and listeners and so on. So thank you for giving me a chance to talk about it, Sina.
Thank you, Ali. Thank you so much. I'm going to press stop.